Welcome to Kingston Reid's Word to the Wise podcast series for HR and safety professionals.
Hello and welcome to the latest installment of Kingston Reid's A Word to the Wise podcast series. I'm Duncan Fletcher, partner in the Perth office of Kingston Reid, and I'm back again with Jess Tinsley and Michael Mead, our special counsel and partner from the Sydney office. Hello, Jess. Hello, Michael.
Hey, Duncan.
Hey there, Duncan.
Well, it hasn't been long. We promised part two last week and we're already here. Last week we talked about the ratchet effect of some of the increasing re-regulation of the workplace, firstly off the back of the first term Labor government and now with some changes to penalty rates regulation, particularly the enshrining of penalty rates in awards. And we then focused on how that is interacting with working from home demands and really what might be described as the tug of war between unions and employers over the issue of employment flexibility, working from home, but in an increasingly regulated environment. And the question that we asked was, well, what does that mean for employers, particularly from a productivity point of view? And timing is everything. Not long after we published our first episode, we've had the federal court provide some very important guidance in the Fair Work Ombudsman proceedings against Woolworths and Coles regarding the offsetting of employment entitlements under the award. Michael, in our first episode, you suggested that employers should look to contractual offset terms in response to the federal government's new penalty rates legislation. How does that decision from last week, the Woolworths and Coles decision, impact that advice?
Yeah, thanks, Duncan. It didn't take long for that advice in that earlier podcast to become somewhat dated. Look, I think the short answer is that this decision from the federal court that we've been waiting keenly for really does introduce some new complexity and issues for employers to consider in relation to how contractual offsetting terms and set off ultimately applies. Now, the decision, for those that haven't been across the media reports and various write-ups that have already been landing in relation to this matter, effectively the large controversy that was before the court in both the Woolworths and Coles matters was the effect of effectively set-off arrangements that sought to apply over award payments that might apply in a particular pay period against other pay periods where there might be a deficit. And although there might be some further distance to run in this in terms of whether Woolworths and Coles ultimately decide to appeal the decision, then the net effect of what was determined by the court last week is that contractual offset terms need to be precise in the way in which they describe the exact award or enterprise agreement terms that are being offset. So broadly framed terms, which are common in most contracts, won't be sufficient anymore. So too, and also quite importantly, the ability to offset needs to arise in the same pay period. So you can't use the overs in a particular pay period to effectively offset the unders that might arise in another pay period. And those are things that will have some, I think, significant consequences, Duncan, in relation to the availability or the utility of trying to use common law arrangements to engage with the penalty rates issue that we discussed just last week.
Now, Jess, does that mean that individual flexibility agreements might become fashionable, finally?
I think it's they've been long waiting their day in the sun, and I think it's looking that way. Certainly, we were having a chat before we started recording, and, you know, individual flexibility agreements, as you know, many of our listeners will know, are things that are found, concepts that's found in the award system that a lot of employers have traditionally been avoiding, but certainly something that increasingly, as we're seeing more and more complexity around, you know, including as a result of this decision, you know, something that employers might be looking for that security of, you know, entering into some of these arrangements.
Which does suggest a more rigid and regulated approach. You mentioned in the first episode that the Greens are pushing for changes to the regulations to ensure that employers keep records of their penalties and overtime rates and time worked, even when an employee is being paid an annualised salary, and that's a legitimate annualised salary under an award provision. I say legitimate in the sense of it being prepared under the award rather than a common law arrangement. Do you think it's necessary in light of the federal court decision for employers to keep these kind of records?
Well, I think it's from memory, I think in the first episode I suggested that it may not be necessary, and it turns out that, well, luckily for me, I was right. So the federal court in the decision that just been discussing has made clear that for annualised salary or set-off clauses, you know, don't have that effect of relieving employers of their record-keeping obligation in relation to penalty rates, which we know it falls under Regulation 3.33, and also overtime, so that being Regulation 3.34. The other interesting thing that came out of the decision as well, Duncan, was something that a lot of employers do rely on, being, you know, the clocking and rostering data being a something that a lot of employers will keep to try and satisfy these record-keeping requirements under the regulations. But the court's been quite clear in this decision that clocking and rostering data are not sufficient to constitute records for the purposes of these regulations. So I really think a key takeaway here is that employers can't rely on requiring employees to fill in, say, timesheets out to meet these record-keeping obligations.
That's really interesting. And I think it really means that the punch card is also going to be fashionable again, in the sense of having a record that records the time actually worked rather than a roster which records the anticipated working time. Interestingly, we talked last week also about the concept of working from home and the fact that that's a major workplace issue. Michael, the tempting approach is to use the employer laptop or computer access as a form of punch card by using workplace surveillance to establish when people are or are not working at home. But is that viable in an environment where unions and employees are increasingly challenging employers about the use of that kind of workplace surveillance?
Yeah, look, it's a really good question, Duncan, and we're probably coming right off the back of what was a really highly publicised misstep by an employer that effectively used company-provided laptops and turned the laptops, you know, recording and microphone devices as a form of monitoring whether in fact employees were working at home. And that's obviously something that has caused the ire of unions and also focused the attention of this discussion in terms of what is the appropriate remit for employers to actually be able to monitor those things. Look, I think at a workplace level, the Fair Work Commission has generally found that employers have the right to introduce various types of surveillance so long as employees are aware of those measures. And that obviously involves communicating policies or doing it at a policy level, providing training and education about the application of those measures. That case I was talking about where effectively the employer covertly used its laptops as a listening and surveillance device was not an instance, given the covert nature, that anyone was aware of it until it kind of bubbled to the surface. So I think there's a risk that obviously that serves as a bit of lightning rod for the issue. Jess, I'm not sure if you have any thoughts about the way in which employers are currently approaching that issue and anything else that might be happening at a legislative level concerning workplace surveillance.
So I think that's it's a good question. And it's clear, Michael, that these media reports couldn't have come at a worse time. So we know, you know, leading up to the Economic Reform Roundtable, the unions have a big push in terms of restrictions on workplace surveillance. We also know that there's various, you know, here in New South Wales, we've got a push by the New South Wales government to really link workplace surveillance with sort of health and safety risks as well. So the New South Wales government's quietly introduced a bill about a month ago or so that essentially links the a duty of care on companies to prevent excessive or unreasonable monitoring of workers. We also know that Safe Work Australia is consulting with its state and territory members about this issue of whether there is a health and safety risk on workplace surveillance. So at a time when employers are increasingly needing to rely on workplace surveillance, they're facing pressures in regards to potential new restrictions on its use. But if, as you said, Michael, though, if we actually go through with the way that the Fair Work Commission deals with this, it's certainly a common sense approach there. You know, we know that we've got surveillance is generally prohibited under all state and territory laws unless the person has provided their consent. And then we know, as you mentioned, Michael, that in terms of the Fair Work Commission, that if you generally have a policy or procedure in place, that you can, you know, your employees are aware of the workplace surveillance measures that are put in place, that you can do that. So, but, you know, we've got these media reports of one instance, which is clearly so far outside the realms of, you know, what's common sense. So I think it's not many people out there that would disagree with the prospect of, you know, secretly recording on Teams in their personal homes, you know, conversations with their families and their, you know, their pets is, you know, outside, you know, the realms of what would be reasonable. But we do know, as we've both mentioned, that there really is a system in there that does already protect employees, you know, through this more common sense approach. And just really finally as well, Mark, if you look at we've got brand new statutory tort for serious invasions of privacy as well. So it'd be really interesting to see whether this particular case would be something that, you know, member of staff might bring an application under that. So be it, you know, potentially a first sort of test case for those new tort provisions.
And Michael, what does it all mean for where we started with the Coles and Woolworths type obligations to record people's time spent at work? How do we find a balance between these two issues?
Duncan, the balance is going to be very difficult to strike, I think, because ultimately, if you look at the Coles and Woolworths decisions, obviously, as Jess has already said, the court identified that relying on the terms of a annualised salary arrangement or a set-off arrangement doesn't allow you to avoid the record-keeping obligations in the regulations. So if you overlay that in the context of, you know, the idea of working from home, there would still be requirements, irrespective of how you're remunerating people, to keep records of when they are performing work, and those records need to be separate and distinct from just when they might be rostered or expected to work, but when they're actually discharging duties. You know, the court in Coles and Woolworths were kind of critical of the idea that was put by one of the employers that you can take two sets of records and kind of aggregate their rough content to meet the requirements under the regulations. So, as scary as it might sound, we might be finding ourselves in not too distant future having conversations with employers about timesheets in circumstances where employees are working from home, just so those employers can mitigate the clear risk that exists in terms of discharging their record-keeping obligations under the Act.
Sharing the pain, you know, from not just lawyers anymore, everyone.
So timesheets might take over the world. That's as I think for the three of us, that's a pretty scary thought. So and it's difficult to see how there can be any other way. It just seems like the creation of records for the sake of creating records in circumstances where there's perhaps a failure to trust that employees will do the right thing and that employers will do the right thing. There seems to be an element of sort of mutual distrust that's underpinning the workplace relationship at the moment and producing a lot of these demands for greater regulation and claims that we've seen for underpayment. In that circumstance, and with this concept of trust in the back of our minds, one option obviously is for employers to give up on a conventional employment relationship and rely increasingly on artificial intelligence to do work, because there can't be a sense of mutual distrust with artificial intelligence. But the introduction of artificial intelligence itself is another point of tension between employers and employees. What's your view, Jess, on what the future of AI looks like in the workplace?
It's a really interesting question. So if you talk to the union movement, it's certainly something that I'd say it's probably one of the ACTU's biggest pushes at the moment, and has been, I think, since the end of their lobbying in terms of the three suites of legislative change in the last term of government. The ACTU's really focused their attention now on regulating AI in the workplace. And this is, you know, stemming from concerns from workers and unions broadly that, you know, the implementation of AI and automation more broadly is leading to job losses. It's obviously a counterpoint to that argument there that, you know, adopting technological change in the workplace can create jobs and new skills as well. But putting that to one side, I think it's certainly worth sort of diving in very briefly into what the union movement is pushing for, and then touching on, you know, well, how likely is the government to actually follow? You know, what are the chances here that we will have changes to the Fair Work Act in this space? So just looking at the union movement's push, we know that they made a big announcement heading into the economic reform roundtables, or as I'm dubbing the productivity roundtables, in last month. And the calls there were really around this concept of an enforceable agreement, which they would like to be a new set of mandatory enforceable agreements that would compel employers to consult with their staff before new AI technologies can be introduced into workplaces. So that these agreements would also, you know, make guarantees around job security, skills development and retraining, sort of transparency over technology use, and then addressing also privacy concerns as well. So I guess the big stick in this would be, in their proposal, would be that companies who do not implement enforceable agreements would miss out on government procurement work in particular. They're also calling for a national AI authority and a new AI Act. And then also some other points, including expanding the list of, I guess, permitted matters that employers and their workers can bargain over. Although perhaps we can sort of have a look at that and whether those changes are actually necessary in light of the sorts of new terms we're seeing in enterprise agreements every day. But I guess just for the second point here, how likely it is that the government will introduce these changes. And it's been an interesting few months just in terms of getting an understanding on where the government might be headed on AI regulation generally. We know in the last term of government, the former industry minister was looking to implement some mandatory guardrails. It appears that that has been, on the use of AI, it appears that that's been scrapped. And there seems to be a real sort of back and forth at a cabinet level between those that want to look at existing legislation and existing laws to fill any gaps. So we're, you know, potentially making change to the Fair Work Act or the Privacy Act, for instance, versus those that might look for the introduction of a new AI Act. So I think just actually the this morning, so in terms of we're recording now in the afternoon, there was part of the PM's speech for a speech he's giving for Business Council's annual dinner. There was some interesting remarks. I think the PM hasn't really said much on this issue so far, but there was a brief part in that where he said that he's supportive of AI as long as there's protections in place to protect workers. So it would be interesting there to suggest what he might mean by that. So I certainly can see us getting to a place where we might be seeing some, you know, change of the Fair Work Act in this space.
I think another area that is going to be increasingly scrutinised is the role of unions in prosecuting these matters. And I think from my perspective, the future is going to be quite delicate because, as I said before, there seems to be quite a bit of mutual distrust. And that seems to be fueling calls for greater regulation and claims from and disputes from employees who believe that they're being that they're not receiving what they're entitled to. From my perspective, it looks like we're moving from a world where there was less regulation and employers could effectively, as long as they were complying with the baseline of minimum entitlements, could essentially create their own world contractually, provided the safety net was met, with employees. But that world seems to be changing. And I guess my observation would be that in this new world, there just needs to be a much greater focus. In the past, employers perhaps tended to know that the award was there, but just proceed on the basis that they were well above it, to now having to actually engage line by line with the award. And that's perhaps the world that the employee side wants us to operate in. Michael, what would your observation be?
Well, I think, Duncan, my closing thought probably picks up on one of the strands that you just alluded to before making those observations about the greater regulation. And that's that I think in the space of AI, whilst the government will do whatever the government does in terms of setting revised legislative parameters around the use of AI and or its own purchasing power to bring employers to the table, I think we are going to see increasingly more novel claims being made by unions in enterprise bargaining. The observation that Jess made about a levy on businesses in relation to training for AI, you know, that has the hallmarks of various other union-led levy schemes to secure and protect employee rights and entitlements, like portable long service leave, for example. The other thing that we commonly see, obviously, is that when a cause for training arises, the union can be very quick to spring into action to set up its own registered training arm and then encourage employers through claims and enterprise agreements to effectively have employees subscribe and registered within those training arms at a cost to the employer for the delivery of that training. The other and final thought I had, and Duncan, you might be old enough to remember, I certainly do, early in my career, particularly in and around manufacturing, you used to have some common claims dealing with where redundancies arose as a result of the introduction of technology. There were differentiated entitlements either by way of notice or severance pay, as distinct from redundancies that might arise as a result of a downturn in work. I guess in a world where that which is old is new again, it wouldn't be too remarkable in my mind if we saw some of those kinds of union claims sitting on logs of claims in front of the employers that are our clients.
Chatbot redundancy pay. Jess, what do you think?
I think in terms of, you know, what's ahead in this term of government, we've been talking about AI, and it's certainly something that I can see the government making looking to introduce some level of change. How broad that will be in relation to AI and the workplace is certainly an area to watch out for. But you actually think about in terms of what the union's pushing for, including around consultation obligations for employers when they are looking to implement AI, the use of AI in recruitment processes or determining when to promote or terminate employment, for instance, and also in terms of even additional consultation rights and job security in relation to enterprise bargaining. I think while we're potentially looking down the barrel of changes in the area, if you actually look at what the union's calling for, I think it's quite clear that our current system already deals with that. So a question mark there would be, well, how can employers prepare for potential legislative change in the space? And I think that the easy answer there is to do things that you already would be required to under the existing laws. So I think if we look at, say, the consultation obligations for a significant change in the workplace, undoubtedly that does. If it amounts to a significant change to the workforce, then the implementation of AI or automation would be a significant change already. So it's not a matter of new consultation obligations in the future, because they're already here. You know, we're talking about the ACT looking to include more enterprise agreement terms around the use of AI. But, you know, you hear about it, you know, media reports quite regularly these days about particular enterprise agreement deals around, you know, banning automation for the life of the agreement, or, you know, additional consultation rights. These are already things that a lot of employers that do bargain with their workforce are already seeing. So that'd probably be my prediction and my, I guess, my big tip.
Fantastic. Thanks, Michael and Jess. It's been a great conversation, and look forward to talking to you again. Thanks very much.